Farside FM.
No.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, welcome to the First Cut. Today we're talking about Gaza, a place where the humanitarian situation is beyond urgent. The healthcare system is in crisis. Aid has been blocked since March 2nd, and medical staff are being killed in staggering numbers. But beyond the statistics, there are real people living this every day. And I'm very grateful to be joined by my guest today, Stephen. He's seen the reality firsthand as a former head nurse with MSF. He's worked in Gaza, witnessing both the resilience of people and the impossible conditions that they face. So Stephen, David, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi. Stephen. I'm a nurse activity manager with MSF. That basically means I run all of the nursing activity. as the simplest thing, but it usually, as in with any hospital, you end up doing a lot more extra stuff.
Right.
From the nursing side, it's the nurses that run everything. Sorry, doctors. But it's so it's a lot of managing people, managing resources, managing how we deliver the aid that we're lucky to receive to the best possible way that we can. As you'll probably know, MSF hires, I think, about 80% of its staff are nurses. I might be totally wrong on that one. But it's certainly 80% of its staff are national staff, which that's locally hired staff. That's people who are from the region that we're working in. Mm. Gaza is no different. If anything, it's even more so. We don't have very many teams, international staff, going in. Because it's hard to get there, as well as aid being blocked, international staffing and health is being blocked. So we only have small teams that go in. So I was of a team of three or four of us, really three medical staff, four or five international staff total, running the. Running a hospital in the middle area of Gaza in Deir al-Balah. So it's we rely very, very heavily on the locally hired Gazan staff that we have there, who are all, to a man and woman, fantastic.
And can I ask you, when was that work that you did in Gaza?
So I came back from Gaza in end of December, just before. I think I got out Boxing Day. I was there for just 6 weeks, which is the length that we do with international staff in a context like that. There's a lot of heavy bombing and a lot of it's just a very stressful environment generally, so we try and limit the amount of time that our staff can be in there, the international staff. But you got to remember that we're working with people who live through that. So not only are we working with people who are like us, working just as hard as we are, as many hours as we are, they are in themselves displaced. So they're people who, a lot of our staff are people who are working in hospitals in the south or hospitals in the north, and have been pushed like everyone else into the middle area. From my understanding, a lot of the reason for pushing into the middle area is that the Israelis believe that there's a high water table, so you can't dig tunnels. So a lot of the resources in the south and north have been completely pummeled, and that means everyone pushes into the middle. So there's a large amount of IDPs, internally displaced people, in that area. And it's an area that's gone from being a little, almost like a seaside town that people would visit from the city. Gaza's a city of 1 million people. Gaza City was a city of 1 million people. It used to be a place that people would come to visit the seaside or go to their place in the country, if they had family in the country, it would be a very sparsely populated area that now has all those people shoved into one area. So it's a lot of tents, it's a lot of overcrowding. There's not a lot of jobs, not a lot of work. It's kind of amazing how people are surviving. So even just going from our house to the hospital every day was, you know, it's a very interesting thing to see how people are managing. MSF, we rely very heavily on acceptance. So we don't have, certainly never in any context do we have security or guns or anybody protecting us in any way in that sense. We rely on the protection of the community, essentially, which is that they accept that we're here to help. And we had that in spades in Palestine.
And did you find that the community did accept you for the most part? That did you ever have any big issues or?
No, not at all. If anything, actually, it's a desperate situation where people don't have food. People don't have the price of food is staggering. So I can come in and complain as an international staff coming in and saying, oh, we didn't have this, we didn't have that. But these people are living with it every day. Mm. So it's quite understandable that in those situations you would have crime. You would have you would expect there to be kind of international people to be targeted in some way, but it's not at all. I've done a couple of missions in Palestine, and it's a wonderful place with wonderful people. And certainly there is a huge community feel to the place generally. Everybody wants to help their neighbor. Everybody wants to just help you do your job. We even had one situation where there was late at night, there was a guy who apparently was around our house, and the neighbors thought it was sketchy, so they pushed him, they ran him away. Like, it was, I don't know if it was a bad thing or not that was going to happen. We're not really sure. I mean, it's understandable. We were an international staff in such a desperate situation. It's understandable that you would get one or two people that would try and, like, maybe rob from you or do something like that. But for us, it no danger whatsoever from the community. The danger is all coming from the bombs that are going over there, that are from the explosions, from the gunfire that's happening. There's a lot of different problems for the population there, but for us, we certainly had a lot of acceptance. We could go from place to place in normal cars. It was fine.
That's incredible. That I think maybe in part how people are surviving is the fact that there's such a tight-knit community. And I've been following Bizan. I don't know if you've seen Bizan on Instagram, but she's been amazing in showing what maybe more of a reality on what's going on for the people in Gaza at the time. Because I think, I don't know if a lot of other people feel the same way, but trying to get news and facts on what is actually happening is difficult sometimes when you're in England and everything that you've got is got some kind of bias, or you're not sure, especially with the most popular news sites. So what are your opinions on that, and how would you say is best for people to get that information?
Yeah, there is a lot of stuff on social media that's really useful. And I would say follow a lot of different journalists. There's a lot of local journalists on social media as well. And I would say seek that out for sure. Sometimes it could be hard to access if you don't speak Arabic, but there's a lot of English speaking journalists, a lot of whom have died, unfortunately. But yeah, it is true. There's not much information coming out, and they're certainly not making it to the news channels. I don't know if that's as much to do with. It's the same with Ukraine and same with Gaza. I don't know if that's as much to do with boredom of the situation and that. Just population
it's
tends to get
crisis in a long list of crises, and how can you break out of that and stay engaged in a way that actually means something as well?
Yeah, it's true. I don't know the reasons why, but yeah, for sure, there's the idea on the ground, or what's happening on the ground, is definitely not getting out. I've certainly had, since coming home from West Bank and from Gaza, I've certainly had chats with family members even. And you'll have discussions, and then people get very uncomfortable about something. I remember having a conversation with a relative of mine about a situation I'd seen in the West Bank, where we witnessed it. There was a situations where people were being used as human shields by the Israeli forces. It was a, you know, we had the, it was a big news story at the time. It was all over the Guardian. I was in the West Bank when it happened, and I was chatting about this. I was going through. You would go into the camps that they have there. So the in the West Bank, where MSF also has teams working with medical staff there. You will have a block of aid being able to get into the camps. So the army will come in and completely cut off the camp. So that means that the Red Cross ambulances can't get in and get patients who are and this is 2 days long. So we know there's patients inside there because there's a small hub of community members who've got together and started an ambulance service themselves. These guys are crazy and amazing. They're essentially people that just grab medical kit that we supply, put a medical bag on their back and run out into their street while there's bullets flying, and go find patients and treat them and then try and get them to hospital. We supplied them with a it's like a golf cart. It was a medical buggy to transport patients, but essentially it's just a golf cart. And I had one story of we've got it on our website, of a guy who he's a real cool guy. He would help with some of the training that we do in the camp. We'd teach mainly women in the camp how to do first aid, because it was the women that weren't targeted as much, and it was happening on their doorstep. So we were teaching a lot of stop the bleed training, so how to tourniquet. Not as much how to tourniquet. We were trying to stop them doing that, but like how to stop bleeding, how to stop really heavy bleeding, what to do, how to pack wounds, that kind of stuff. Because this stuff was happening to them. Rather than teaching this stuff for the first time, we were teaching this stuff, and they were saying, "Well, I've been in this situation, and this happened."
Can I ask why were you asking? Why are you not teaching them to tourniquet?
It was an interesting one. So with a tourniquet, it's a very dangerous piece of kit. So we were teaching how to tourniquet, but with the proper kit. If you do a tourniquet with say there's a lot of different literature on it, but if you do a tourniquet with an improvised tourniquet, very rarely does it work, and a lot of times it can cause more problems. So what we actually teach is to put direct pressure and really, really hold the pressure as much as possible, rather than using something that's improvised. Because sometimes you can put a tourniquet on that's not designed for it. Say like there's like a belt would be too tight, it could be too small and cause different kind of problems. Or you could use something that will, like, there were the people that were talking about using a bit of cloth and then a pen to be able to tighten it, use it as a windlass to tighten it. But the problem there would be that if you could think that leg is stopped bleeding, but it's not enough of a tourniquet to be able to stop all the bleeding, and that you could think that the patient's fine, but then they could be slowly bleeding out.
It's very interesting how much you have to almost change what medical knowledge you've learned in wherever you've learned it, medical school or anything like that, to actually adapt it to the situation. Because I would personally you've seen it in films or whatever you have seen, but when you're actually in the situation, what really works is so different. And what's really going on is also quite different, which is why it's so interesting. And I'm so grateful that you're here talking about it today as well. So with your journey with MSF, could you tell me what drew you to this work, and how you ended up working for them as well?
I was always very interested in doing something like this. I think I kind of got into nursing to do this. I got into nursing a bit late in life and did some weird jobs beforehand around the world. And I remember I basically did my nursing degree. So I had a degree. I did a nursing diploma. It's like a 2 years intensive course. I thought I'd be do my 2 years, work for, you know, a few months as a nurse, and then then immediately go off with MSF and start doing this, working in this world. MSF very curtly and very correctly rejected me the first time I applied, because you need experience. So it took me 6 years of nursing. I kind of fell in love with the job a little bit. I kind of have worked in the same emergency department in London. I work in a trauma centre in Paddington. Kind of love that job. But no, I needed skills and experience. So the big thing that MSF really requires and desires is, one, it's the ability to go into those areas that are, you don't have the right resources, you don't have the right showering, just to be able to live very closely with people in kind of tough situations, whether that's in a tent in Africa or whether that's in Gaza, where you're using ocean water to wash with.
And how did you know that you were going to be able to deal with that? Or what kind of thought processes did you have to go through before when deciding that you wanted to work for MSF?
I suppose it's from my previous experience, and that's what for people who are interested in joining MSF, that's what they're looking for, essentially. It's a little bit of experience working with working in environments close with people that are in slightly tougher conditions than you would be used to. Like working with maybe in areas of the world where there's less food, or working in conditions where you're working with a small group of people. So for me, it was working in tree planting camps in northern Canada. We would kind of fly into areas and create a camp, and then we'd make the water system, we'd kind of build our own toilets, we'd kind of live in a little camp that we created, and then take it down and leave at the end. And it's that kind of environment that MSF is looking for you to be able to be in. Also, just traveling, like getting out and being in areas of the world that are not, that are slightly deprived, that are just so that you can say on your CV, for example, if people are looking, like, I can go into these uncomfortable areas, I can go do this uncomfortable stuff, and
You're
I'm
gonna have
able
the
to do it.
evidence there and the experience there. Because I
Yeah.
mean, you don't know how you're gonna react really until you're in those situations. It's easy to say a lot of things, but it's amazing that you've actually done it and then still have decided to pursue it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a particular kind of character that is, happy to go do that. It's not just, I mean, the idea is that you wanna be a productive member of the team, right? Like, so the whole point of going into an uncomfortable scenario, like everybody knows they're going to be in an uncomfortable scenario. It's how you deal with it. Are you able to just kind of be like happy and chatty and deal with the stuff that are happening? You're having power outages, you're having cold showers, all that kind of stuff. It's that kind of thing that they're looking for. So if you're looking to apply for MSF, it's good to put yourself in those situations first and be able to say, hey, look, I've gone off and done this work here with X and Y small charity. But it's the conditions that they're looking for. It's that I can live in a tent, I can like live in an uncomfortable scenario, and still be able to work, with my colleagues and be fine doing it. And then the other thing is, which is why I was rejected by MSF the first time, is experience. They want people who are able to provide training. They want people who are able to have knowledge about what's going on. So for me, it took 6 years of nursing to really get myself to a point where I could feel comfortable going into a scenario and teaching people and trying to organize things so that it was, hopefully working that little bit better than when I arrived by the time I left.
And so, when you were accepted onto MSF, can you tell me a bit about how you were feeling at that time? What was going through your head, knowing that you were going to be positioned and deployed in Gaza?
So Gaza, by the time that Gaza had come around, I'd been doing this a while. Yeah, I love this job. It's an amazing kind of experience. There's some really, really cool, interesting things you can do. Like you have these little moments. Like it's hard and tricky, and for sure there's some tough things that happen. It's very intense. You're working. MSF are very helpful with trying to get people breaks and trying to like there's a couple of different ways you can do missions. I tend to do more emergency missions, so it's shorter time period, working quite intensely. rather than the normal missions, which can be a bit more like you'll have a weekday, you'll have weekends, you'll have a bit of time off, you'll have a bit of breaks, and you'll go for longer periods, like a few months, rather than you'll go for maybe 7 months rather than 3, which is the missions I do.
Right.
It's a personal choice, but I tend to feel that when I'm going for a short mission, I prefer to just work as much as possible. But like in Gaza and every mission I go on, you'll always have somebody above you who's saying, no, take a break, don't do that. Like, try and don't come back and just work, try and take a day off, all that kind of thing. We were forced to take a couple of days off in Gaza, and I didn't like it, but it was probably a good thing. But the idea is basically you're working 6 day weeks, 7 day weeks. You're working very quite intensely, and I really like that job. You get to do some pretty wonderful things, meet some pretty amazing patients, meet some amazing. You always work in wonderful teams. So the one really fantastic thing about working with MSF is that you realize that as much as you're kind of putting yourself in situations where you see the dank horribleness of the world sometimes, in that you're also always seeing like a bit of beauty and a bit of like just a bit of wonderfulness. Like there is always, like Gaza for example, there are people in Gaza who are their sole purpose, the whole thing that they're trying to do is help their community. They're coming to work every day in really horrific conditions. People I was working with in our field hospital in Deir al-Balah. That is, you've got staff who are coming every day. They are coming from a tent. They don't have simple things. They don't have a washing machine, so they have to clean their clothes in ocean water. They have to spend a crazy amount of money on food. There's no protein. There's no meat. There's no eggs. But they're coming to work every day, and they really want to help. The one thing I have in my job is doing, say, I'll do the roster or organize that kind of stuff. People don't want days off. Nobody wants a day off because this,
Wow.
why do I want to go be in a tent? I want to
Wow.
work. I want to help people.
It
That's
makes you think,
they're
doesn't
really.
it? Everyone wants a day off here, but nobody wants a day off in places like that. And you can see why. But it is, I think, as you say, so nice to see the difference. Because when you're in that kind of environment, when you're losing faith in humanity almost. I mean, me, as I've been following it, I've just been really struggling to understand and see the light in it. But then you see these teams that are working tirelessly, and these people that are just so focused on community and helping other people, that it really does just kind of give you another bit of hope that I'm not
Yeah,
sure.
that I honestly, genuinely, I did come back from Gaza with, and I understand that feeling of watching the news. If anything, I'm one of these statistics of people who watches the news less lately because of the amount of shite going on in the world. But it's there's the one thing I get from, or was able to get from Gaza was coming back, and I didn't feel coming back from there that, oh God, this is, I mean, it's an awful situation. There is terrible things happening. We're witnessing it. It is truly a desperate, horrible, everything you can imagine, place to be. For the people that are living there, it's horrific. The one thing I don't get coming back from it is a feeling of hopelessness or despair, because there are people there that are, there's doctors there that are working, that could easily have left, could easily have gone to Europe and used their skills somewhere else. But they're there not just for this war, but they've been there for the last 14 wars, working with patients, desperately trying to push their skills. We had, so we were, well, we were a surgical hospital. We had two operating theatres. And we had orthopedic surgeons who could easily be working elsewhere. We had doctors who were like amazing doctors who could organize and sort out like so many different moving parts to be able to control, as well as doing their orthopedic surgery. We had the only two plastic surgeons working in Gaza, who were trying to, who had really were so focused on trying to help their patients. It's kind of unbelievable how fantastic it is.
Yes.
And then we've got, and you know, we were doing general surgery. Like, it's kind of amazing watching these guys and like watching the staff do all this stuff. That they're really, that their sole focus is on trying to help their community as much as possible. They're really, really focused on that. It's pretty amazing.
And have there been any specific moments for you that have really stood out that maybe make you smile, just thinking about this kind of sense of community and just kind of real drive to help people as well?
Yeah, there's I was chatting about this recently, actually. I've been looking at a few situations, but there was a nice one in Gaza where, so we would do ward rounds every morning. So it was usually myself and the medical lead. So it was a doctor from an American guy who lived in Australia most of his adult life, and a really, really funny guy, good to work with. And we would go around doing these ward rounds every day. And so it's, you know, going through every patient with every speciality, having a little rundown of what's going on with the patient, how, you know, however long they've been there, are we in the right track? We would go from the doctors to the nursing staff, so the nurse would present, the doctor would then explain their stuff. We also had the physiotherapist, which is a really, really key resource in a place where you've got a lot of amputations, a lot of patients just need to get up after surgery and get moving. So we had a very good physiotherapy service, and we had a mental health team that were there as well, which is key. Anything in Palestine is mental health. Every single aspect of Palestine should be focused, have some focus on mental health, and we were no different. So we had quite a lot of pediatrics there. We had, and I remember we had, kind of close to the start of my time, we had a young boy and girl who came in after an explosion that had happened where their father had been killed. So really horrific situation. The young boy had been really close to the dad, both physically and just emotionally, generally. So he was finding it really, really hard. He basically watched his dad die. And he had really horrific burns on his neck, his arms, and his hands. So he couldn't really use his hands. We were doing what we call dugas, so it's a term I had not really found until I got to Gaza, but it's dressing under general anesthesia. So we would take the patients sometimes once a day, sometimes once every couple of days, to clean the wounds. So to take the dressings off, clean the those, because they're such bad, horrific burns. And do it either under a general anesthetic or do it with some sort of ketamine or some sort of kind of derivative to get them to not feel or see what's going on. This young boy was having daily dugas at one point because his hands were really, really bad. I had this little thing I used to do with all the kids where I'd just do this kind of like a handshake thing. It was silly and stupid, and I probably looked like an idiot every day doing it, but I quite enjoyed it, and it was quite nice to like come in and you do like a little silly handshake with the kids. And with this young boy, I couldn't do one because he had his hands. And at first, genuinely, you would see from him that he was just not there. Like, so and it's kind of heartbreaking. You hear a lot about PTSD, and you hear a lot about this kind of how this affects people in Gaza. It's I don't think it's the same. It's that it's continuous, it's ongoing. So this boy's fearful of the bombing that's happened, but he's hearing bombing around him all the time. There's bombing going on around the hospital all the time. You can hear it every day. And one of the things that we were doing, or kind of in a situation we were forced to do, is triggering his PTSD every day by taking him to theater. Right. So he would, with different drugs that we were using when we were trying to do the dressings, he would come back and be just as traumatized. So it's like he's back in that bombing with his dad. It was either he was disassociated and he would just not be there and he'd be terrified and we'd be trying to chat to him, or he'd be screaming. And he's like a young lad, but just screaming his head off, like genuinely could not. This, at times, sometimes you could have a chat with him and talk to him. Sometimes with ketamine, you can be put into this disassociative state, so it doesn't matter what we're saying, what we're doing. He's not in pain, but he's just screaming. There's nothing that can stop that. So we had to work all together as a team every day to try and work out how to deal with the situation. So the mental health team were doing their stuff, trying to get him to, work every day with the other kids, try and get him into play groups, try and get him doing stuff, which was tough for him because he didn't have his hands to be able to use things. So he couldn't join in the activities as much, couldn't do the drawing that they were doing or play some of the games that they were trying to get him to play. And every day we'd send him in and it was a similar thing would happen. I was there for 6 weeks, so that he came roughly at the start of my time. By the end of my time, so the start was really brutal for this young boy. He would smell sulfur, and that's not there, and he would just go into this, either a rage or just complete fear. Like, it's kind of hard to watch. So that was the start. Slowly over time, we worked and worked and worked and worked, and really, this is the team that are there. These are the mental health guys, as the physios trying to get him out in the morning. These are the anesthetics doctors really trying to talk about, okay, we can't use this drug because it's not working for him. We need to use a different one. It was a lot of work from everyone to try and improve the situation better and better and better every time. And by the end of my time, we were getting him to go to theater, and he was coming back and he was talking to us and having a chat through this whole situation. Mm-hmm. He was, his hands were healing. He just had a skin graft just as I was leaving. He was smiling and a bit happier. I remember there was a ward round I'd go around, and then by the end I was doing this kind of like elbow bump thing with him, instead of the handshake. Just a really, really beautiful moment. My last day, I had a bit of Nutella saved up. There's people really have nothing, so just having Nutella on bread to go around and hand that out to patients. So one of the guys did that for me. We were doing that, especially with the kids and that, just giving them a bit of chocolate was like a big, big thing. And him and his mom came up, found out that that was why they were getting Nutella, because I was leaving. I was trying to give a bit of a thing to people before I went. I got a nice picture with him and a little chat with his mom and like a big hug off the guy, because it was a lot of work, and he really put a lot of work in himself, like for a kid that young to have to really try and understand and work through those horrible situations while having bombing going on around him all the time. It was quite amazing that someone's able to do that at such a young age.
What a beautiful story that is. And I think it's those moments and those stories that I'm sure might make it worth it for you going and working for MSF.
Yeah, that's the nice thing about our job. We get to see those wonderful moments. Mm. Even in horrific, horrible situations, you get to see the really nice little moments of things that happen that really kind of stick with you. Mm. The one thing about all this work, like there's horrible things going on everywhere, but there is also like real beauty in the darkness.
Yeah, 100%. And it's obviously so important to talk about everything in Gaza, to talk about the statistics. But when you get onto that human level and you talk about these human stories, the good and the bad, and I'm not sure if you think that maybe that's a better way of getting news across to people, or I'm just trying to think of ways that we can kind of bridge the gap, because I'm not sure about other people, but I felt quite helpless in the UK in terms of what I can actually do to help, if anything. So I'm not sure if you had any thoughts on that.
I'm biased for sure, because I work and I see the work that we do as in MSF. I had a friend of mine who had a few weeks ago had a dinner thing and got a bit of money together to help with Gaza, and was asking me where should I put my funds, and they were chatting to somebody over Facebook, and they wanted to send money directly, which is a thing you can do. There's a lot of people that you can do over social media, but to be honest, as someone who's works with a relatively big organization that's been there from the start, that's really trying to do lots of different things. The one thing I can say, and I said this to my friend at the time, is that it takes a lot of work to be in Gaza. It takes a lot of effort, a lot of resources. So I was lucky enough to also work in the West Bank, and I saw the things that we were doing. So it's not just the medical teams that are working with MSF, it's a huge amount of logistics around it. So we have, as well as having like HR staff and people that are there for security that are on the ground, we also have teams in Amman and in Jerusalem that are working on just the logistics of getting things into Gaza. And it's really, really needed. There are so many things that we were lacking and did not have. Simple things like you can't get lead in, so we were doing X-rays without being able to barrier. So we were putting sandbags up to be able to barrier the X-ray department. These guys that are doing the X-rays don't have any kind of protection, really. You'll have your radiographers in a hospital that'll go behind a shield, or they'll have a little detector on that says how much radiation they're getting, and if it goes over a certain amount, they can't work for the rest of the month. Whereas these guys, they don't have any of that. They have no protection whatsoever. So simple things like that, trying to get that stuff in, that takes like a lot of negotiation with the Israeli side, trying to understand like, okay, if we send in this truck and it has this on, it'll get rejected. The whole truck will get rejected. So we really have a big team of people working in Amman, in Cyprus, in Jerusalem. Like I've been to our offices. This is just one section in MSF, where you go downstairs and there's just a whole team, an army of people working on how the logistics of getting material into Gaza. I was very lucky that I was there at a time when we had gotten a lot of stuff in, but when we started the field hospital, it was done kind of last minute. We weren't really. We were trying to prepare and prepare and prepare and get ready to start this field hospital. But then there was an evacuation order for Al-Aqsa Hospital, which has been happening a lot in this conflict, where the army will come in and say that this hospital needs to be evacuated completely, and then everybody has to leave. So you go from having a hospital where it's not just got patients, it's got IDPs, it's got a lot of people who are around the hospital there for protection. If you're in a situation like that where there's bombing everywhere, the thought process is get your family close to a hospital, maybe it won't be bombed. So that the hospital in August last year was sorry, oh yeah, it would have been August last year, was evacuated, or was had an evacuation order, and MSF decided to just start the field hospital. We weren't really ready and prepped. We didn't really have the right amount of equipment and stuff and things available. But it went from being a dirt patch to just with tents and a few couple of standing structures, a full entire working field hospital. So by the time I left, we had the capability to have 70 beds. We were trying to think about how to go to 110, and we had two operating theatres running with an A&E department, an inpatient department, and an ICU. These things happen really, really fast, but it feels on the ground like, okay, we're just rushing into things, but actually it takes so much work from all the logistics teams, all of the supply teams, all of those guys that work really tirelessly to try and get that stuff in. It's a huge amount of funds to be able to get the stuff. It's a huge amount of funds to then be able to push it into Gaza. It's a huge amount of funds to be able to understand the situation and negotiate with the right people to get that stuff in and get it in there safely and get it to our warehouses in Gaza to be able to then give it to the population properly. It's a lot of work. So I would be selfish and say, consider giving money to MSF. We do good work and we need it.
I think
It's
that makes
used.
a lot of sense to me. And when you're talking about these situations where you're working with such a lack of resources, has there ever been a time where you've had to make some tough calls in deciding to treat somebody and not somebody else?
That happens very, very regularly.
If you feel comfortable with it.
I'm not just Gaza. Gaza is definitely the case. I worked. My first project was in Baghdad, and it was a we ran an ICU. So I went there in, I think it would have been 2022, start of 22, I'm trying to remember. But no, so we had an ICU in Baghdad that was a COVID ICU. When we started, like most ICUs in Iraq, the mortality rate was 98%, which is it's quite staggering, but true. Most ICUs in Iraq, if you're intubated in Iraq, you've got a really high chance of dying. So we came in with a couple of different things to be able to manage that. We managed to get our mortality rate down from 98% to 60%. It's a really good effort, but it's still quite a lot of your patients dying every day. There was a few reasons for that. One was that we weren't intubating patients, so we made the decision, as well as the Iraqi government made the decision, that if you just have COVID, you shouldn't be intubated in Iraq, because the mortality rate was just so high. A lot of people were getting infections that really couldn't be managed, and it became impossible to be able to handle patients intubated. So we were looking after patients with NIV, BiPAP, CPAP. The toughness of this, so more than half of your patients are dying. It was a pretty brutal project from the start, but we had situations where we're looking after patients who really should, if they wouldn't be if not even intubated at home, they would be on ECMO at home. They would be really, you would be putting a lot of resources into these patients that we just couldn't put those resources in, either because we didn't have them, or because we knew that if we intubated patients, that they would die anyway. They would get a really horrific infection, and it was impossible to keep that from happening. So we were looking after patients and trying to manage patients on NIV that we knew were going to die. It's tough being in those scenarios. Like, I remember there's a particular case of a 17-year-old that, to be honest, was in the ED, that was probably too sick to come to us. But one of our doctors made an emotional decision. He was a 17-year-old, to try and bring him to the ICU, give him a chance. We knew there wasn't really much of a chance, and I've never seen anybody. So if you try and imagine, if your regular respiratory rate is, between, let's say, like 13 and 20, a really sick patient's respiratory rate of like 24. It's the first thing that goes off. If your respiratory rate goes off, that's the first sign that you've got a really sick patient, especially in COVID, but just generally. So you would be looking at a patient with 24 respiratory rate and start thinking, okay, I'm worried about that patient. Most of our patients in the ICU were running at a respiratory rate of around 30, because they were very, very sick. This boy, and I've never seen this, and it's quite staggering to witness, was respiring at about 78 breaths a minute.
78.
78 for 2 days. That you can't treat that. It's not something that, you know that it's just trying to make him as comfortable as possible. You can't treat that with an IV. This boy for sure at home would have had ECMO. And that's not a possibility in Iraq. So it becomes a tough thing to be able to manage, tough thing to be able to go with. We worked really hard on him. We're throwing lots of different stuff at this young lad. The big thing it was a big kind of change for us about the whole system, the way everything worked in that ICU after that, because we were with the family, and the family saw every day that we were coming in and working really hard trying to get him, as if not, we knew we wouldn't save him, and we were explaining that, but we were trying to make him as comfortable as we could. It's impossible for the family not to see that we're there every day, we're working really hard, we're trying to push, we're trying to do stuff. And we were having these conversations around with the family around preparing them, like you do with any patient, saying, okay, we don't think this is going to work, we think this is going to happen, we think it's not going to be positive outcome. And in Iraq, there's a big culture of not just in our unit, but in almost all hospitals in Iraq, there's a big culture of what you would call kind of pay family for show CPR. essentially. So if you're doing CPR for a COVID patient, you know realistically it's kind of pointless. It's their lungs that have failed, their heart is failing because their lungs have gone. If a patient is going to die, there's very few chances where CPR is going to be effective. Normally back home in England, you would have that conversation with families. You would say, okay, if the heart stops, we're not going to continue for this reason, this reason, this reason. It's not going to work to be able to do CPR. And when I first arrived, we were doing a lot of, you would have a lot of the culture from just other places that are going around Iraq, where there'd be CPR to show the family, hey, we're doing everything, but it's not working. There's a lot of instances like that that'll happen. And we, as the international staff, were a bit uncomfortable with that because we'd want to, you know, we're coming from our situation where we would explain to the family and have a discussion. And we found it very hard to be able to try and implement that there. You know, it was almost kind of part of the medical culture to just do CPR on every single patient that's about to die so that the family sees that the doctors have done everything. With this young boy, because we were explaining with the family all the time and because we were really on it and having a chat with them, it really started a big sea culture change in the whole unit. Because then the Iraqi doctors then were having those conversations, led by one of the British doctors that we were working with, who spoke Arabic, from Egyptian guy, he had an Egyptian family. It led to a big change of being able to, the doctors were then starting to have conversations after that with the family, saying, okay, like this isn't working and this isn't going to work and this is, you know, we're not going to do CPR for this reason. And it went from being something that culturally everyone said, oh, God, no, you can never accept that in Iraq, to actually starting to change that culture a little bit and give our patients a little bit more of a dignified death, more and more. So although it was, there was some, you know, you get some terrible things a lot of the times from this, you can actually institute a bit of change and do something a bit positive, because it's not nice to do CPR on a patient that doesn't need it. That's, you know, it's not going to work for.
No. So I think that's incredible that you've managed to have such an impact and hopefully kind of a long lasting impact, not just on a patient to patient basis, but more in terms of how things are run and how people actually operate and how people see healthcare. Because I think there's been a big change as well into how people see doctors, how they see nurses, and there's been a big kind of shift from it being doctors are up here, I tell you what to do, and to kind of bringing it more back down to a level basis. And we're both human beings. There's obviously a difference in the fact that some people are more vulnerable if they're in hospital, and you've obviously got knowledge that they don't have, but putting yourself on that same level with them, having those conversations, I think is very important. So if I could just ask you, Nasib, how do you think after you've come back to England from these different places, seeing these different things, how do you think it's changed you as a person? And how do you think you see things, maybe everyday things, differently now?
I'm definitely a lot more calmer in stressful situations at work.
Right.
No, I mean, I still work now in trauma center ED, and it's definitely made me a little bit more. Obviously, you work in scenarios in Gaza, for example. You know, there's only a certain amount of blood we can give patients. So we're making decisions on patients. Say for in the UK, I've been in Code Reds, where you give up to 26 units. And it's a really intense, and you're smashing blood into a patient. In Gaza, you they'll tend to make a decision on 2 units. Once the patient's had 2 units. If that patient isn't really going to survive or is going to require a large amount of blood after that, then they're starting to make a decision about do we palliate or not. Mm. And then once we decide to make that decision to palliate patients because of resources, you can't effectively look after those patients, we're trying to make them as comfortable as we possibly can. But you then notice, like, it takes a while. Like, it's not something that's... so this thing that goes from being a really, really, you know, fast situation, right? We've got to do this, 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 and this. You realize actually you've got to, do have a little bit of time to be able to manage and look after this patient and make them comfortable.
For people that might not know, when you say palliative care, what do you mean exactly for patients?
This is say, for example, if we have a we have staff working in Alaxa, so working in Alaxa A&E department. I went to visit, but my main job was working in the field hospital, either getting referrals or sending referrals to them. Alaxa is the main hospital. It's run by the MOH, the Ministry of Health in Gaza. And that's where it's gone from being a tiny little field hospital. It's gone from being a tiny little, we'd say DGH, like a little small, tiny village hospital, to being the main hospital in Gaza very, very quickly. It has a lot of fantastic staff, but it's not very much resources. They'll be in situations a lot where they'll have huge mass casualties. And then they'll make decisions on patients to manage their resources. So if they think a patient is going to be able to survive to theater and manage, they'll push as many resources as they can into them. But they have less resources than we do at home. So we'll have maybe not an unlimited supply of blood, but essentially you can give as much blood as you need for that patient to be able to survive. In Gaza, that's not the case. So there'll be a lot of more decisions made quicker around, okay, this patient may survive if you give them 8 or 10 units, but they probably won't. We've done 2 units and it's not working. They'll make a decision, okay, we need to palliate, which is essentially then making your patient as comfortable as possible and allowing them to die, knowing that you can't fix what's going on. So whether it's because they've had such a big brain injury, or whether they've had such a big vascular injury that they're not going to make it. These decisions are made really quickly because it's a very intense environment with lots of patients coming in all at once, and then you'll push these patients what we call to our blue area, which essentially is where you'll have a nurse who will be going around making sure that the patient isn't in pain and making sure that the family are aware and know what's going on, and trying as best they can in a really difficult scenario to make that death as comfortable as possible. And one thing I hear from colleagues and stuff is that takes a lot longer than you would think. You get a patient in as a code red that is this big huge thing that you've got to jump on as fast as possible, every second counts, and then a patient will be, okay, we can't work on this one for this and that reason, and we move them to the blue area, and it takes a bit longer than you would think. A code red for me is something, essentially, you'll have a code red for a patient that's bleeding out. It's gonna die. So in a trauma scenario, code red means we need to give that patient blood as fast as possible, or they're gonna die immediately. Mm. And these are the kind of patients that are coming in. And it's just an interesting to hear some of my colleagues chat about it, especially with some of the brain injury patients. That are not intubated, and you would expect that. Okay, this patient we've got just very limited amount of time to intubate, to get them up to ICU, to get them to theater, to get a bolt put in, to be able to understand. When you don't have those resources, then being managing like those patients and looking after them, it's actually takes quite a lot of work. It's quite a lot of intense, it's quite intense for the nurse who's in that area, looking after those patients. Then to be able to manage with the family, explain what's going on, and have the knowledge to be able to say, okay, this is catastrophic brain injury that's not going to survive, and that's, yes, they might be with you for a little while, and they're breathing, but they're not really with us anymore, and it's hard for someone to understand. It's hard for someone to do that job. I think after hearing that and really understanding how rough that can be, it's quite hard to go into a situation in the UK where we have all the resources. We have a CT scanner. There's no CT scanner in Alaxa. They have to send them to somewhere else. We can understand what's going on with patients. We are able to diagnose everything and say it's definitely this, and this is that. That's what's going on, and this is why that's not happening. It's hard not. It's hard to. I guess coming into the UK system, and you're very appreciative of what you have. of like the resources they have available, of all the things that are going on. It's very hard to get into a kind of mindset of like, oh, this is too much, this is horrible. It's busy in the UK for sure. We've got a government that's not really looking after our NHS and hasn't been for a long time. And it's busy and horrible, and there's loads of different things going on, and there's not enough resources, and you're moving things around a lot. But it's not that. So I think it gives me an appreciation, actually, for working at home.
Yeah.
Like, we have a lot of resources. We have a lot of stuff. The NHS is crumbling and failing in loads of ways, but if you're about to die, we'll treat you. We'll look after you. We'll help you. That's a nice thing.
Yeah. And so, do you do anything in particular when you come back to the UK after being in such a different place to kind of process your feelings, to process what's happened? Do you have any kind of specific things that you do? Or?
Yeah, so MSF has a lot of resources that you can use. They certainly for stuff like Gaza, we have you kind of have to have a conversation with a psychologist when you come back. You know, like, have to. It's a good thing. You'll have a, so they'll have a one-to-one meeting a bit like this with a psychologist. You have that resource available if you need it ongoing. I personally I've got good friends I chat to, you know, especially people who I've now working for a while and people who've been there. So I actually had a very nice a few weeks after coming back, I had a very nice couple of pints with some friends a friend of mine who I worked with in Iraq, who'd been in Gaza working my job before me. And then the guy who I took over from was also living in London. So, you know, the three of us with another one of the lasses that was working in Al-Aqsa, so it was like three of the nurse activity four of the nurse activity managers all together going for a drink. That's nice to have a chat about that. It's around the time that the ceasefire happened, so it was a nice evening. For me personally, like, I usually go somewhere or do something. Like, after I got back from West Bank, I cycled to Estonia.
Wow. Wow. I wasn't expecting cycling to Estonia, but that's...
Wow. No, it was a nice little trip, actually. But, you know, I think the next one I do, I'll go do the Camino or something. Like, it's nice to just get away and sit and concentrate on something else for a little while.
Yeah. And so I know that you mentioned that you had some friends that had also been deployed in places and probably understand a lot of the feelings that you've been having as well. But when you talk to other people, do you find that most of them don't really want to engage with the reality of what you've been through? Do they just kind of ask you how things have been out of politeness, or how do you feel about that?
So I recognize I'm a bad talker, and like I ramble, but I was trying to mention this before. So I had a family member who I was chatting to when I got back from West Bank about human shields.
Yes.
And I was explaining the story about how when I first got there, I was talking to guys in the camps. So we one of my first days, we were in one of the camps in Tulkarem had been sieged essentially for 2 days, and we were getting shown around the camp by some of the people that lived there, some of the guys that do this ambulance service, community ambulance service, and it was the first time I was meeting them. It's the first time I was there, and I'm very much from a political ideology and viewpoint of a two-state solution, and that there is two sides to every story, and that, you know, I'm trying to come in with a moderate mindset. I don't think I came in, as many of my colleagues do, with as much of a, you know, one side is right, one side is wrong. I think there is a bit of a mix, and I was getting shown around. I you know, so I'm giving everything a general sense of kind of understanding for everything, and okay, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. And I remember getting explained a story about a guy who was used as a human shield during the siege. And I remember thinking, not that this person was wrong, but that I remember thinking at the start, thinking that maybe, I don't know, a soldier was pushing this guy ahead of him, and that it looked like he was a human shield. Or, you know, maybe it was a situation that misinterpreted in some way. Surely there's not soldiers coming in and using civilians as human shields. It's just not something that doesn't seem right. I'm sure both sides wouldn't really do that. Specifically, I'm sure there's I hate this guy, you hate this guy, come up with a story and I see this kind of thing. But the more I was working in the West Bank, the more we were seeing it, the more we were getting evidence of it, the more we were understanding that it was kind of commonplace. It was happening consistently, that Wow. civilians were being used as human shields. We had one testimony from a small 10-year-old boy who was literally grabbed with a gun put on his shoulder, and then that boy would go and open doors in a house as soldiers were clearing the house. So the boy would be the first one to open the door. Then if anyone was to shoot at the door, it would hit the boy. 10-year-old doesn't even cover your vital organs. It doesn't even make sense. It's just terror. And I was explaining this to my family member, and they're politically active and motivated and stuff. And I was explaining about human shields, and I was saying, oh yeah, I've heard that Hamas are using human shields. And I was like, no, it's the Israelis that are using human shields. At least that's what we're seeing. I'm sure there's badness on both sides. And there was just like a real kind of uncomfortableness in the conversation, and a real kind of switching off of like, and it just became, there was like an air, a cloud around the whole situation. And this is just kind of things that we've seen, like we had, there was video evidence of it being happening. It was in The Guardian, and it's a bit weird to go into a situation and see that level of violence against a civilian population, and try and explain it to people, and then to be then switched off or that doesn't fit my kind of narrative of what that whole conflict is about, so I'm gonna kind of switch away. It's understandable. I get why people do it. Everyone's in their own bubble, getting their own information. But it's important to branch out your bubble. And I'm sure if I'm saying that from a standpoint of the Israeli side as well. I'm sure there are many reasons why there's soldiers that are, acting like that or doing that kind of thing. The whole wonderful thing about MSF, and the thing I really enjoy about working for this organization, is we really genuinely don't care about which side is right, which side is wrong. It's about making sure that civilians get medical treatment. That's our main focus. We are an organization that speaks out. We are an organization that is not there to go in and just give care and not say anything. We do speak out and talk about when we see injustice. And we try and use our feet on the ground, the nature of us being in that scenario and witnessing that. And we do try and talk about it. But our main modus operandi is not to be on one side or the other. It's to try and help both sides.
Wow. I mean, even hearing that story from you, it's something that is unfathomable to understand that is actually happening. And especially when you're seeing videos, it's not the same as hearing a real story from a real person about what's happened. But how did it make you feel that there was that kind of air of discomfort after you were talking about a real experience that you'd had?
I don't know, it becomes a bit, we're all in our bubble, right? We're all in our little world. This is one of the reasons why I don't read as much news. I'm in my left-wing Guardian bubble as much as anyone else or was for a long time. And it is important to understand other views and understand other sides. And it is important to have like an objective understanding of a situation. I have colleagues who are very affected by this and for sure are very like intensely pro-Palestinian. I would even say there's people who would be very, very on one side of this. I personally think that that's not really the way that this whole situation is going to work in the Middle East. You're going to have to work with both sides. Something's going to have to happen that'll be both. But yeah, it's tough, man. There's a population over there that are really, the population is losing. Like whether you look at it on one side or the other, the on a human level, there are people living there that are, they don't have an option, they don't have a choice, they don't have control over their own lives. They're just being put upon by that situation. And a lot of it is down to just a couple of politicians, really. Like, that's kind of the way it always works at the end of the day.
I think a lot about the difference between peace and liberation. And a ceasefire may pause the immediate violence that is going on. But that doesn't mean that the people of Gaza are suddenly safe, especially with what's been happening recently. And it doesn't mean that they're free or able to rebuild. So from your experience, what do you think actually needs to happen for there to be a real lasting change?
Ideally. I'm wholly unqualified to answer that question. I'd like to add, but no, it's So I had colleagues who were going to Gaza City, and around the time I was there, not a lot of organizations were there. So the UN was in Gaza City and had been for a while. That's kind of the nature of what they do. Not a lot of charities and organizations were able to get there. They were banned from being able to get across. There's kind of a couple of dividing lines in Gaza, and one of them is a big road that's been put across the middle area. Not really very far from us, but you weren't able to get across. The army were completely cut off and blocked. The population were allowed to leave Gaza City, but they weren't allowed to go back. And neither were the humanitarian organizations. We as an organization lobbied heavily to get into Gaza City, because there's people there. There's still civilian populations living there. It's definitely a lot more sparse. It's gone from being a city of 1 million to tens of thousands. But there's people there that need healthcare. There's resources and that's basically where the population are going to have to be. Despite what Trump says about turning everything into a golf resort, like this, that's where the population is going to go back to. So we as MSF were really, really heavy on trying to get in there. We had some colleagues who managed to do that while I was there. Oh. And hearing some of their stories was rough, man. Like you had, one of our security and logistics experts, one of the Gazan guy who's been working on the ground with MSF for years, and he went into Gaza City to go look at how we would start a couple of projects. We're now supporting a small medical facility there, trying to give as much resources as they need, because it's a lot less of a population, but a huge need. They were going to look at that, and hearing my colleague chat about it, he was talking about, driving in the street, the city that he's known since he was a kid. He's from Gaza City, and he didn't even have, it's a rubble. There's nothing there anymore. So he didn't have any landmarks. So he's then talking to the driver about, no, you need to go left down this way. And the driver's saying, no, we're not in that area of the city. We're in this area, completely different area of the city. Imagine being in your own city and being in a completely different area of the city and not realizing, because you don't recognize any of the landmarks around. Like, it really affected him. Like, it would affect me. Like, I can't imagine being in an area of Newcastle and not being able to recognize it, because it's just rubble. Like, it's kind of insane. And the thing is, we have staff that have been working there the whole time. MSF had a facility in Gaza City that was a medical project that had been working there. Most of our staff left. A lot of them came and ended up with us working in the middle area, but some of them stayed. MSF didn't ask them to stay, didn't request anything of them, but they stayed in the warehouse that we had. With some of the materials that were there, and they were giving out to population themselves. So there was one of the ladies that worked with MSF ended up staying, like putting a family in the MSF office that had been in Gaza City. Like everywhere else, it had become rubble. But was then like working out how to, the little resources that were there that we just abandoned and had to leave because it was too dangerous to be there. And we, as with us and our local staff, most of everyone left, Some people stayed behind, and she was one of them, and she just stayed there, being like working and working out a way to try and give aid to the local population. We were in touch with her, but we couldn't really get there. So it was the first time we were able to, when I was there, it was the first time we were able to get to Gaza City. It's quite humbling to see that. Like, that's people that are just really trying to help. There's no nothing else they can do. There's nothing in it for her to be able to stay behind and look after that equipment and that stuff and try and give it out to people as best she can. So there's nothing in that for her. She's just doing that because that's the kind of person she is. It's pretty amazing.
Wow.
That's the one of the nice things about MSF is that those people are everywhere.
Yeah. Including who I'm talking to right now. And I think you made a really good point as well. So you're from Newcastle, I gathered.
Yeah.
That you can't imagine going to Newcastle and just seeing rubble around you. And I think for the vast majority of people, they can't imagine that. Their hometown being turned to rubble. And I think the world maybe is becoming desensitized to this. And I worry with every new crisis, Gaza risks being forgotten or treated as just another headline. And I suppose it's just how do we make sure that doesn't happen? I mean, we've talked a lot about what's needed in Gaza, but I suppose another question is, what do you think we need to change here in the UK in the way that we talk about conflict, the way that we engage with these global crises, and what's missing from the conversation?
Engagement is definitely a big thing.
Mm.
I'm guilty of it myself. Like, you know, it's a very easy thing to be able to switch off from just politics in general. Like, it's all pretty kind of annoying. Like, I did a politics degree before I did my nursing degree.
Really?
And it's like it's kind of like sausages. Once you learn about how a law is created, you're kind of disgusted by it a little bit. And it is true.
Like,
it's a pretty grim reality. Like, I've got family who work in politics. It's tough. But I think it's just the thing is it is just staying engaged, like understanding that really it is we all as a population like do have more control than we realize. Like, if we all get together and kind of actually do something, there isn't anything we can't achieve. There are loads of little ground level engagement societies, political groups, action groups, and it's working at a local level as much as you can. There are I've got friends and colleagues who are very, very active in free Palestine movements as well. And there's a lot of really fantastic stuff. And there's as well as it being a fantastic thing to do, there's actually a really nice community in there.
Yeah.
You know, like going to some of these marches and going to some of the stuff, like you meet a lot of very interesting and thoughtful people who are engaged themselves and have a knowledge of it. If you're really kind of interested in this thing, go to your local, your next march, go to your next kind of meeting. They are actually full of people that are very interesting and nice to meet. And from just a social aspect of considering we're all sat on our phones around so much, doing something like that is actually very good.
Mm.
And yeah, there are teams and there are people around the world that are doing this stuff. There are many different organizations that are working in these areas. And if you're looking for like a different way of understanding these situations, like MSF website has lots of different stories and things that we post that we're putting around. Many other organizations have the exact same thing, stories on the ground that are going on. Like, just seek it out, look for it, change your algorithm. Look for that kind of stuff.
Yeah, 100%.
It's out there.
And so, Steve, what are the next steps for you? What's your plan going forward? Do you have anything else planned with MSF? Or
I would love to go back to Gaza, right. But I at the moment I'm trying and failing to finish a master's that I've got. I'm doing a disaster management humanitarian response masters at Manchester, so I've got my dissertation for that due in August. So
very
I'd love to say my focus is on that, but I keep finding anything else to do instead of doing my actual dissertation. But yeah, I'm trying to do that at the moment. But no, that's the nice thing about MSF is once you get to a certain level, you know, of experience, you can You can jump in and jump out, and they're very accommodating on that front, obviously within reason. But it's yeah, no, they're very accommodating on trying to get people who've been out before to go again. And if you take a break, you I've got wonderful people in the office in London, and they're really great about me taking a break for a while and coming in later. So it's a nice organization to work for. I'm very lucky.
It sounds like it. And so, finally, with everything that you've experienced, everything that you've witnessed, what is one thing that you would want people to take away from this conversation? If they only remember one thing from today, what should it be?
Probably shouldn't say this, but it's yeah, give some money to an organization, man. Like if you are thinking about working in this field, say if you're it's a medical student podcast, so I imagine you've got a lot of medical students. There are some fantastic things you can do to start that process. One is getting involved with charities. There's multiple different charities that you can work with at a lower level. Okay, that sounds awful, but that are smaller than MSF, say for example, that are easier to work with. There are so get doing that kind of stuff, get traveling, get seeing the world, get understanding what's happening around you, not just locally but everywhere. Those are the kind of things that MSF are looking for. There's a fantastic if you're ever interested in moving into this field, there is a fantastic course that I did from the nursing side, but also has a medical one. For me, it was tropical nursing at London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. There's one in Liverpool as well. I think it's called Liverpool School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine as well. I might be wrong. But it's probably the best training that I've ever done in anything to do with nursing. For me, it was a 6 month course going once a week. And you get to learn about how to work in these kind of environments. And it's fantastic. You learn an incredible amount from world experts that are coming in and doing your lectures. And the medical side, it's a bit more intense. I think it's 6 months and you're full time, but it's a really, really amazing course to do. I've got colleagues who've done it and loved it. It's also kind of a prerequisite if you want to work in this field and get experience, get knowledge, get like. For
Get
me, it
out
was
there.
I moved to ICU for a little while, even though I kind of hate ICU, to get a bit of extra understanding. I need to do a bit more pediatrics because pediatrics is a very important thing working out there, and I'm recognizing more and more that's something that I need to add to my bow. Yeah, there's loads of things you can do to prepare for this kind of stuff, and if you don't, and you're working in this field is not for you. There are organizations out there, MSF being just one, that are doing fantastic work. So give them some money.
Yes, I think that's a great message. And I just want to take a moment to say thank you as well, not just for being here, but for the work that you've done and the perspective that you've shared. I know it's been invaluable for me. It's easy to feel overwhelmed, I think, with everything that's happening in the political landscape of today. We've got world leaders on CAT and everything that's happening in Gaza as well. But conversations like this remind us that we can't look away. There are real people behind these headlines, and that we all have a responsibility to stay informed and engaged as well. So if this conversation has resonated with you, don't let it end here. Like Steve said, donate some money, get involved, keep listening, keep learning, and most importantly, take action. Whether it's supporting MSF, other organizations, raising awareness, getting involved in those local in those local what would you we've got the camps, we've
There's
got
action groups. Yeah, there's
sports.
loads of different things going on. At your local level, there's a million different things. Whether it is at a local level or it is international, there's a fantastic amount of things available.
You've got to push for this political accountability, and none of us are powerless unless we choose to be, I suppose. So thank you very much for joining me, Steve, on the first cut. And I'll see you next time.
Thank you, Sophia.
I'll stop.